For an instant, I saw the fizzling as a slow expansion of green matter. It was a silent explosion. The water burst into a brilliant green mist which expanded until it had enveloped me. I remained suspended in it until a very sharp, sustained, shrill noise shook everything. The fog seemed to congeal into the usual features of the water's surface. The shrill noise was Don Juan yelling, "Hey!" close to my ear. He told me to pay attention to his voice and go back into the fog and wait there until he called me. I said, "Okay," in English and heard the cackling noise of his laughter. "Please don't talk," he said. "Don't give me any more okays." I could hear him very well. The sound of his voice was melodious and above all friendly. I knew that without thinking. It was a conviction that struck me and then passed. Don Juan's voice ordered me to focus all my attention on the fog but not abandon myself to it. He said repeatedly that a warrior did not abandon himself to anything, not even to his death. I became immersed in the mist again and noticed that it was not fog at all, or at least it was not what I conceived fog to be like. The fog-like phenomenon was composed of tiny bubbles, round objects that came into my field of vision and moved out of it with a quality. I watched their movement for a while, then a loud, distant noise jolted my attention and I lost my capacity to focus and could no longer perceive the tiny bubbles. All I was aware of then was a green, amorphous, fog-like glow. I heard the loud noise again, and the jolt it gave dispelled the fog at once, and I found myself looking at the water of the irrigation ditch. Then I heard it again, much closer. It was Don Juan's voice. He was telling me to pay attention to him, because his voice was my only guide. He ordered me to look at the bank of the stream and at the vegetation directly in front of me. After a few moments, Don Juan ordered me to return to the fog and asked me again to pay attention to his voice, because he was going to guide me so I could learn how to move. He said that once I saw the bubbles, I should board one of them and let it carry me. I obeyed him and was at once surrounded by the green mist, and then I saw the tiny bubbles. Don Juan's voice kept on urging me to follow one of them and mount it. I wondered how I was supposed to do that, and automatically I voiced the word, "How?" I felt that the word was very deep inside me, and as it came out, it carried me to the surface. The word was like a buoy that emerged out of my depth. I heard myself saying, "How?" and I sounded like a dog howling. Don Juan howled back, also like a dog, and then he made some coyote sounds and laughed. I thought it was very funny, and I actually laughed. Don Juan told me very calmly to let myself become affixed to a bubble by following it. "Go back again," he said. "Go into the fog. Into the fog." I went back and noticed that the movement of the bubbles had slowed down, and they had become as large as basketballs. I viewed them as if I were looking through a window. That is, the frame of the window did not allow me to follow them, but only permitted me to view them coming into and going out of my field of perception. When I ceased to view them as bubbles, however, I was capable of following them. In the act of following them, I became affixed to one of them, and I floated with it. I truly felt I was moving. In fact, I was the bubble, or that thing which resembled a bubble. Then I heard the shrill sound of Don Juan's voice. It jolted me, and I lost my feeling of being it. The sound was extremely frightening. It was a remote voice, very metallic, as if he were talking through a loudspeaker. I made out some of the words. "Look at the banks," he said. I saw a very large body of water. The water was rushing. I could hear the noise it made. "Look at the banks," Don Juan ordered me again. I saw a concrete wall. The sound of the water became terribly loud. The sound engulfed me. Then it ceased instantaneously, as if it had been cut off. I had the sensation of blackness, of sleep. I became aware that I was immersed in the irrigation ditch. Don Juan was splashing water in my face as he hummed. Then he submerged me in the ditch. He pulled my head up over the surface and let me rest it on the bank as he held me by the back of my shirt collar. Don Juan told me to come out. I noticed an urgency in his voice. "I'm green," I said. "Cut it out," he said imperatively. "You have no time. Get out of there. The water is about to trap you. Get out of it. Out, out." I panicked and jumped out. "This time you must tell me everything that took place," he said matter-of-factly, as soon as we sat facing each other inside his room. He was not interested in the sequence of my experience. He wanted to know only what I had encountered when he told me to look at the bank. He was interested in details. I described the wall I had seen. "You moved very fast," he said, "as fast as a man who knows how to perform this technique. I had a hard time keeping up with you."
"You mean, Don Juan, that I really traveled in the water?"
"You did, and very far, too."
"How far?"
"You wouldn't believe it." I tried to coax him into telling me, but he dropped the subject and said he had to leave for a while.
Don Juan returned the next day, late in the afternoon. In the meantime, I had written down everything I could recollect about my perceptions. When Don Juan arrived at his house in the late afternoon, I accosted him and insisted on reading my account to him. He refused to listen and made me sit down. He sat facing me. He was not smiling. He seemed to be thinking, judging by the penetrating look in his eyes, which were fixed above the horizon. "I think you must be aware by now," he said in a tone that was suddenly very severe, "that everything is mortally dangerous. The water is as deadly as the Guardian. If you don't watch out, the water will trap you. It nearly did that yesterday. But in order to be trapped, a man has to be willing. There's your trouble. You're willing to abandon yourself." I did not know what he was talking about. His attack on me had been so sudden that I was disoriented. I raised the point that it was humanly impossible to be controlled at all times. He maintained that for a warrior there was nothing out of control. I brought up the idea of accidents and said that what happened to me at the water canal could certainly be classed as an accident, since I neither meant it nor was I aware of my improper behavior. I talked about different people who had misfortunes that could be explained as accidents. "All I can say to you," Don Juan said, "is that a warrior is never available. Never is he standing on the road waiting to be clobbered. Thus he cuts to a minimum his chances of the unforeseen. What you call accidents are most of the time very easy to avoid, except for fools who are living helter-skelter." "It is not possible to live strategically all the time," I said. "Imagine that someone is waiting for you with a powerful rifle with a telescopic sight. He could spot you accurately 500 yards away. What would you do?" Don Juan looked at me with an air of disbelief and then broke into laughter. "What would you do?" I urged him. "If someone is waiting for me with a rifle with a telescopic sight," he said, obviously mocking me, "if someone is hiding out of sight waiting for you, you won't have a chance. You can't stop a bullet." "No, I can't, but I still don't understand your point." "My point is that all your strategy cannot be of any help in a situation like that." "Oh, but it can. If someone is waiting for me with a powerful rifle with a telescopic sight, I simply will not come around." My next attempt at seeing took place on September 3rd, 1969. Don Juan made me smoke 2 bowls of the mixture. I remember that when my body was thoroughly numb, Don Juan held me by my right armpit and made me walk into the thick desert chaparral that grows for miles around his house. I cannot recollect what I or Don Juan did after we entered the brush, nor can I recall how long we walked. At a certain moment, I found I was sitting on top of a small hill. Then, very faintly, I heard Don Juan's voice talking to me. "Now you must look at me," he said as he turned my head to face him. He repeated the statement 3 or 4 times. I looked and detected right away the same glowing effect I had perceived twice before while looking at his face. It was a mesmerizing movement, an undulatory shift of light within contained areas. There were no definite boundaries to those areas, and yet the waving light never spilled over but moved within invisible limits. I scanned the glowing object in front of me, and immediately it started to lose its glow, and the familiar features of Don Juan's face emerged, or rather became superimposed on the fading glow. I must have then focused my gaze again. Don Juan's features faded and the glow intensified. I had placed my attention on an area which must have been his left eye. I noticed that there the movement of the glow was not contained. I detected something perhaps resembling explosions of sparks. The explosions were rhythmical and actually sent out something like particles of light that flew out with apparent force toward me and then retreated as if they were rubber fibers. Don Juan must have turned my head around. Suddenly, I found myself looking at a plowed field. "Now look ahead," I heard Don Juan saying. In front of me, perhaps 200 yards away, was a large, long hill. Don Juan spoke to me again. It took me a moment to understand what he was saying. "Do you see a man in that field?" he kept on asking. Don Juan took my head in his hands from behind. I could see his fingers over my eyebrows and on my cheeks and made me pan over the field, moving my head slowly from right to left and then in the opposite direction. "Watch every detail. Your life may depend on it," I heard him saying over and over. He made me pan 4 times over the 180-degree visual horizon in front of me. At one moment, when he had moved my head to face the extreme left, I thought I detected something moving in the field. I had a brief perception of movement with the corner of my right eye. He began to shift my head back to my right, and I was capable of focusing my gaze on the plowed field. I saw a man walking alongside the furrows. Don Juan must have noticed that I had seen the man. He asked me repeatedly if the man was looking at me or if he was coming toward me. I wanted to tell him that the man was walking away and that his back was turned to me, but I could only say no. Don Juan said that if the man turned and came to me, I should yell and he would turn my head away in order to protect me. I had no sense of fear or apprehension or involvement. I coldly watched the scene. The man stopped walking at the middle of the field. He stood with his right foot on a ledge of a large round boulder as if he were tying his sandal. Then he straightened up, pulled a string from his bag and wrapped it around his left hand. He turned his back to me and, facing the top of the hill, began scanning the area in front of him. I thought he was scanning because of the way he moved his head, which he kept turning slowly to his right. I saw him in profile, and then he began to turn his whole body toward me until he was looking at me. He actually jerked his head or moved it in such a way that I knew beyond a doubt that he had seen me. He extended his left arm in front of him, pointing to the ground, and holding his arm in that position, he began to walk toward me. "He's coming," I yelled without any difficulty. Don Juan must have turned my head around, for next I was looking at the chaparral. I saw Don Juan moving to a spot perhaps 20 yards away. He walked with such incredible speed and agility that I could hardly believe it was Don Juan. He turned around and faced me and ordered me to gaze at him. His face was glowing. It looked like a blotch of light. He said something to me. I struggled to understand and lost my view of the glow. And then I saw Don Juan as I see him in everyday life. He was a couple of feet away from me. He sat down facing me. I perceived once more the effect of pulsating explosions of light emanating from an area which must have been his left eye. I noticed that perceiving was more than sighting. It was feeling. The pool of dark liquid light had an extraordinary depth. It was friendly, kind. The glow had a very lovely and delicate way of touching me, of soothing me, which gave me a sensation of exquisiteness. Don Juan must have turned me around once more, for I was again looking at the plowed field. I heard him telling me to watch the man. The man was standing by the boulder looking at me. I could not distinguish his features. His hat covered most of his face. After a moment, he tucked his bag under his right arm and began to walk away toward my right. He walked almost to the end of the plowed area, changing direction and took a few steps toward the gully. Then I lost control of my focusing and he vanished, and so did the total scenery. The image of the desert shrubs became superimposed on it. I did not recollect how I returned to Don Juan's house, nor do I remember what he did to bring me back. When I woke up, I was lying on my straw mat in Don Juan's room. I looked at my watch. It was 11 p.m. I went back to sleep, and by 1 o'clock the next afternoon, I thought I was myself again. I wandered to the back and found Don Juan sitting by the irrigation ditch. When he saw me approaching, he made frantic gestures to make me stop and go back into the house. "Run inside," he yelled. I ran into the house, and he joined me a while later. "Don't ever come after me," he said. "If you want to see me, wait for me here." I apologized. He told me not to waste myself in silly apologies, which did not have the power to cancel my acts. He said that he had had a very difficult time bringing me back, and that he had been interceding for me at the water. "We have to take a chance now and wash you in the water," he said. I assured him I felt fine. He gazed into my eyes for a long time. "Come with me," he said. "I'm going to put you in the water." "I'm fine," I said. "Look, I'm taking notes." He pulled me up from my mat with considerable force. "Don't indulge," he said. "In no time at all, you will fall asleep again. Maybe I won't be able to wake you up this time." We ran to the back of his house. Before we reached the water, he told me in a most dramatic tone to shut my eyes tight and not to open them until he said to. He told me that if I gazed at the water, even for an instant, I might die. I kept my eyes shut as he went on submerging and pulling me out of the water for hours. The change I experienced was remarkable. Whatever was wrong with me before I entered the water was so subtle that I did not really notice it until I compared it with the feeling of well-being and alertness I had while Don Juan kept me in the irrigation canal. Water got into my nose and I began to sneeze. Don Juan pulled me out and led me with my eyes still closed into the house. He made me change my clothes and then guided me into his room, had me sit down on my mat, arranged the direction of my body, and then told me to open my eyes. I opened them, and what I saw caused me to jump back and grab onto his leg. I experienced a tremendously confusing moment. Don Juan rapped me with his knuckles on the very top of my head. It was a quick blow which was not hard or painful, but somehow shocking. "What is the matter with you? What did you see?" he asked. Upon opening my eyes, I had seen the same scene I had watched before. I had seen the same man. This time, however, he was almost touching me. I saw his face. There was an air of familiarity about it. I almost knew who he was. The scene vanished when Don Juan hit me on the head. I looked up at Don Juan. He had his hand ready to hit me again. He laughed and asked if I would like to get another blow. I let go of his leg and relaxed on my mat. He ordered me to look straight ahead and not to turn around for any reason in the direction of the water at the back of his house. I then noticed for the first time that it was pitch black in the room. For a moment, I was not sure whether I had my eyes open. I touched them with my hands to make sure. I called Don Juan loudly and told him something was wrong with my eyes. I could not see at all, while a moment before I had seen him ready to hit me. I heard his laughter over my head to my right, and then he lit his kerosene lantern. My eyes adapted to the light in a matter of seconds. Everything was as it always had been. This was the first time I did not believe in the final reality of my perception. I had been edging toward that feeling, and I had perhaps intellectualized it at various times, but never had I been at the brink of a serious doubt. This time, however, I did not believe the room was real. I complained that I did not feel well and told him what I had seen. He laughed at me, saying that to succumb to fright was a miserable indulgence. "You're frightened without being afraid," he said. "You saw the ally staring at you. Big deal. Wait until you've seen him face to face before you shit in your pants." He was interested in the scene of the plowed field and in every detail I could remember about the man. "That ally was beckoning you," he said. "I made you move your head when he came to you, not because he was endangering you, but because it is better to wait. You're not in a hurry. A warrior is never idle and never in a hurry. What was the meaning of the acts he performed? By looking at you, he meant he welcomes you. He showed you that you need a spirit catcher and a pouch, but not from this area. His bag was from another part of the country. The rest of the scene was meant to help you locate the exact place to find him. I know now where the place is. I'll take you there very soon." Don Juan dissuaded me from going back to Los Angeles the next morning. Apparently, he thought I still had not totally recovered. He insisted that I sit inside his room facing the southeast in order to preserve my strength. He sat to my left, handed me my notebook, and said that this time I had him pinned down. He not only had to stay with me, he also had to talk to me. I really did not want to talk at all. I'd begun to feel anxious and restless. Don Juan apparently found the situation utterly ludicrous. He laughed till the tears came. "Don't tell me that at a time when you should talk, you're not going to find anything to say," he said, his eyes shining with a mischievous glint. "You want to know what your death may be like?" he asked me with a childlike delight in his face. I found his mischievous pleasure in teasing me rather comforting. It almost took the edge off my apprehension. "Okay, tell me," I said, and my voice cracked. He had a formidable explosion of laughter. He held his stomach and rolled on his side and mockingly repeated, "Okay, tell me," with a crack in his voice. "You drive a great deal," he went on saying. "So you may find yourself at a given moment behind the wheel again. It will be a very fast sensation that won't give you time to think. Suddenly, let's say, you would find yourself driving as you have done thousands of times. But before you could wonder about yourself, you would notice a strange formation in front of your windshield. If you look closer, you'd realize that it is a cloud that looks like a shiny whorl. It would resemble, let's say, a face right in the middle of the sky in front of you. As you watched it, you would see it moving backward until it was only a brilliant point in the distance. And then you would notice it began moving toward you again. It would pick up speed, and in a blink of an eye, it would smash against the windshield of your car. You're strong. I'm sure it would take death a couple of whams to get you. By then, you would know where you were and what was happening to you. The face would recede again to a position on the horizon, would pick up speed and smash against you. The face would enter inside you, and then you'd know. It was the ally's face all the time, or it was me talking, or you writing. Death was nothing all the time, nothing. It was a little dot lost in the sheets of your notebook. And yet, it would enter inside you with an uncontrollable force and would make you expand. It would make you flat and extend you over the sky and the earth and beyond, and you would be like a fog of tiny crystals moving, moving away. I was very taken by his description of my death. I had expected to hear something so different. I could not say anything for a long time. "Death enters through the belly," he continued, "right through the gap of the will. That area is the most important and sensitive part of a man. It is the area of the will and also the area through which all of us die. I know it because my ally has guided me to that stage. A sorcerer tunes his will by letting his death overtake him. And when he is flat and begins to expand, his impeccable will takes over and assembles the fog into one person again. Don Juan made a strange gesture. He opened his hands like two fans, lifted them to the level of his elbows, turned them until his thumbs were touching his sides, and then brought them slowly together at the center of his body, over his navel. He kept them there for a moment. His arms shivered with the strain. Then he brought them up until the tips of his middle fingers touched his forehead, and then pulled them down in the same position to the center of his body. It was a formidable gesture. Don Juan had performed it with such force and beauty that I was spellbound. Later on, he wanted me to drive him to the nearby town. I mentioned that driving would be a welcome change for me because I was still shaky. The idea that a sorcerer actually played with his death was quite gruesome to me. "To be a sorcerer is a terrible burden," he said in a reassuring tone. "I've told you that it is much better to learn to see. A man who sees is everything. In comparison, the sorcerer is a sad fellow." "What is sorcery, Don Juan?" He looked at me for a long time as he shook his head almost imperceptibly. "Sorcery is to apply one's will to a key joint," he said. "Sorcery is interference. A sorcerer searches and finds the key joint of anything he wants to affect, and then he applies his will to it. A sorcerer doesn't have to see to be a sorcerer. All he has to know is how to use his will." I asked him to explain what he meant by a key joint. He thought for a while, and then he said that he knew what my car was. "It's obviously a machine," I said. "I mean your car is the spark plugs. That's its key joint for me. I can apply my will to it, and your car won't work." Don Juan got into my car and sat down. He beckoned me to do likewise as he made himself comfortable on the seat. "Turn on your car now," Don Juan said. I turned on the starter and automatically stepped on the gas pedal. The starter began to grind without igniting the engine. Don Juan's laughter was a soft, rhythmical cackle. I tried it again and again. I spent perhaps 10 minutes grinding the starter of my car. Don Juan cackled all that time. Then I gave up and sat there with a heavy head. I had the certainty Don Juan had only mesmerized me with his laughter and made me believe I could not start my car. With the corner of my eye, I saw him looking curiously at me as I ground the motor and pumped the gas furiously. Don Juan patted me gently and said that fury would make me solid, and perhaps I would not need to be washed in the water again. The more furious I could get, the quicker I could recover from my encounter with the ally. "Don't be embarrassed," I heard Don Juan saying. "Kick the car." His natural everyday laughter exploded, and I felt ridiculous and laughed sheepishly. After a while, Don Juan said he had released the car. It started. September 28, 1969. There was something eerie about Don Juan's house. For a moment, I thought he was hiding somewhere around the place to scare me. I called out to him and then gathered enough nerve to walk inside. Don Juan was not there. I put the 2 bags of groceries I had brought on a pile of firewood and sat down to wait for him, as I had done dozens of times before. But for the first time in my years of associating with Don Juan, I was afraid to stay alone in his house. I felt a presence, as if someone invisible was there with me. I remembered then that years before I had had the same vague feeling that something unknown was prowling around me when I was alone. I jumped to my feet and ran out of the house. I had come to see Don Juan to tell him that the cumulative effect of the task of seeing was taking its toll on me. I'd begun to feel uneasy, vaguely apprehensive without any overt reason, tired without being fatigued. Then my reaction at being alone in Don Juan's house brought back the total memory of how my fear had built up in the past. The fear traced back to years before, when Don Juan had forced the very strange confrontation between a sorceress, a woman he called La Catalina, and me. It began on November 23, 1961, when I found him in his house with a dislocated ankle. He explained that he had an enemy, a sorceress who could turn into a blackbird and who had attempted to kill him. I came back to Don Juan's house hours later in the early afternoon. He was apparently waiting for me. He came up to me as I got out of my car and examined me with curious eyes, walking around me a couple of times. "Why the nervousness?" he asked before I had time to say anything. I explained that something had scared me off that morning and that I had begun to feel something prowling around me as in the past. Don Juan sat down and seemed to be engulfed in thoughts. His face had an unusually serious expression. He seemed to be tired. I sat by him and arranged my notes. "You forget too easily," he said. "The world is indeed full of frightening things, and we are helpless creatures surrounded by forces that are inexplicable and unbending. The average man, in ignorance, believes that those forces can be explained or changed. He doesn't really know how to do that, but he expects that the actions of mankind will explain them or change them sooner or later. The sorcerer, on the other hand, does not think of explaining or changing them. Instead, he learns to use such forces by redirecting himself and adapting to their direction. A sorcerer, by opening himself to knowledge, falls prey to such forces and has only one means of balancing himself, his will. Thus, he must feel and act like a warrior. I will repeat this once more. Only as a warrior can one survive the path of knowledge. What helps a sorcerer live a better life is the strength of being a warrior." "This brings us to the last point you must know about a warrior," he said. "A warrior selects the items that make his world. Act like a warrior and select the items of your world. You cannot surround yourself with things helter-skelter any longer. I tell you this in a most serious vein. Now, for the first time, you're not safe in your old way of life. Years ago, I told you that in his day-to-day life, a warrior chooses to follow the path with heart. It is the consistent choice of the path with heart which makes a warrior different from the average man. He knows that a path has a heart when he is one with it, when he experiences a great peace and pleasure traversing its length. The things a warrior selects to make his shields are the items of a path with heart. This is your turning point. Now you must surround yourself with the items of a path with heart, and you must refuse the rest, or you will perish in the next encounter. I may add that you don't need to ask for the encounter any longer. An ally can now come to you in your sleep, while you are talking to your friends, while you are writing.